from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Michael Krasny. Coming up, she had a 30-year career in the California corrections system, and as warden at San Quentin Prison, Jeannie Woodford presided over four executions. Now, she's the new director of Death Penalty Focus, a San Francisco-based group committed to replacing capital punishment with life sentences without the possibility of parole. Jeannie Woodford joins us this hour to tell us what she's learned about crime and punishment and why she thinks the death penalty doesn't work. And of course, we'll take your phone calls this hour on Forum. We'll get started right after this. Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in this week for Michael Krasny. Well, by any measure, Jeannie Woodford had a stellar career in the state corrections system. She started off as a guard at San Quentin Prison in 1978, rising through the ranks to become warden at San Quentin, then director of the California Department of Corrections. Now, a woman who presided over four executions at San Quentin is the new executive director of Death Penalty Focus, a group fighting capital punishment. And Jeannie Woodford joins me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. So tell me about this journey for you, starting many years ago as a guard at San Quentin to now becoming the executive director of Death Penalty Focus. Was it an evolution for you in terms of your thinking about the death penalty, or did you always oppose it even from the very beginning?
I always opposed the death penalty. When I entered the Department of Corrections, I entered because I was recruited from the college I was attending, which was Sonoma State. And when they recruited me, they talked about the Department of Corrections being in a period of evolution and that the future was about rehabilitation and that all correctional officers, you refer to as guards, would have college degrees and we would be like social workers. So that was my mentality entering the Department of Correction. Of course, that's not really what
how it worked out.
About,
right? Well, at that time, though, the death penalty was in flux, wasn't it? Because it had been declared illegal, then it was reinstated, and Jerry Brown was governor during that time. And there was a tremendous amount of controversy about the death penalty, but it sounds like that was not really a big part of your thinking when you went into the profession.
That's true. The death penalty was reinstated, and there were inmates on death row when I started in 1978, just a small number. The original death row at San Quentin is very small, and of course, it's outgrown that by two buildings with a current population of over 700 inmates.
And you were obviously a female corrections officer. What was that like back then? Was it where you were very much in the minority, I would think?
There were very few female correctional officers working at the prison. In fact, I was among the first group of women that was allowed to work in the housing units and within just every job within the prison, basically.
And so when you got there, of course, there were executions, or at least there was death row. What did you make of all that?
There weren't executions. There was death row. But when I first started, even though women were allowed to work pretty much throughout the prison, very few women spent any time working on death row. It was several years before I actually entered death row. And when I went to death row, it was half full with inmates on death row. The other half were inmates who were in segregated housing. So I don't think that anyone had the feeling that there would ever be an execution. That certainly seemed to be the attitude at that point in time.
And some people feel that it still seems that way. I mean, we haven't had an execution in California since, I think, 2006. They're on hold right now. Ron George, the former chief of the Supreme Court, says the leading cause of death on death row is old age. Is that the way it should be?
Well, I think that it's time to get rid of the death penalty. When you look at the number of people who are on death row and the money that we spend and the fact that we execute very few people, you know, for good reason, it's just an expensive punishment, and it's a punishment that we don't carry out, and it ends up being a false promise to victims. And it serves no legitimate purpose in our society, really. When you look around the country and find the number of exonerees that have been proven innocent because of DNA, you realize that we no longer can afford a punishment like capital punishment.
Do you think that problem, that innocent people being on death row, is that a problem in California? I mean, we have a very extensive appeals process that some states, like, say, Texas, perhaps don't.
We do have an extensive appeals process that I think assures us, gives us greater assurance that we're not executing an innocent person, but we don't have a perfect system anywhere in the country. And you just can't have a perfect system. When you think about DNA, prior to DNA, we didn't believe any of these people were innocent. And we only have DNA in 20% of our cases. And we've come to learn lots of things about criminal justice. For example, eyewitness testimony is so unreliable, as the California Commission on the Death Penalty discovered when they, you know, looked at the number of exonerees that had been placed on death row because of eyewitness testimony, only to be found innocent because of DNA. You know, the issue of false confessions, also proven to be true that there are false confessions because DNA has shown us that there are. So when you look at all of those facts, you can only conclude that there is a likelihood that we could execute an innocent person in any state in the United States.
When you say that the death penalty offers a false promise to victims of crime, I mean, well, the things that death penalty proponents say is it provides closure, for example, and that it is a kind of justice, you know, that the families who lost a loved one to a brutal crime experience some measure of justice, you know, when this perpetrator is finally put to death. Explain why that is a false promise to families.
Well, first, I'd like to say my heart goes out to the family members. These are very heinous crimes, and I certainly wouldn't want to tell a family member how to feel or what to think. But the fact is, as you pointed out, we have more inmates who die by natural causes or suicide on death row than by execution. And so you have families who wait for years for what they think will bring closure to them. And in fact, we execute so few people, 14 people since the death penalty has come back into being in California. The district attorney in San Diego made that point in that very horrific case that occurred in San Diego when she gave life without possibility of parole to the defendant. And she did so because she said, we need to bring closure to this family now and not run them through years of litigation and the pain of living this over and over again and waiting for something that may never happen, because we have such a lengthy appeals process in our attempt to make sure that we're executing a guilty person in this state.
You, as I said at the top, presided over four executions while you were warden at San Quentin Prison. What were those like for you? And maybe say a little bit about the four, or at least the first one that who was executed while you were there.
Well, it's very difficult on the warden. It's very myself being the warden in those cases, and on your staff. You receive that death warrant 30 to 60 days prior to the scheduled execution. You spend that entire time thinking about executing an individual. You plan for that. So in my opinion, looking back on this, you're spending many days planning the murder of an individual. And carrying your staff through that process, carrying your whole facility through that process. And being the warden, you see it from every point of view. And you try to practice what I would call servant leadership. Be sure all your staff is okay, that the victim family members are okay, that the inmate's family is okay. And it takes a toll on you that at least in my case, I think we are in denial about for many years.
Talk about the staff. There's the execution team who were just recently, I think, replaced at San Quentin or in the process of being replaced, although the new warden there didn't say why that was happening. But what is it like for them? I mean, these are in some cases health professionals, right?
Well, in some cases, yes. The staff believes that they're doing their job, carrying out the sentences of the state of California. And I think they take a lot of pride in being professional and doing their duty. But I know that it takes a toll on them.
Why do you say that?
Just knowing the staff that worked for me and knowing them as well as I did, and staff sharing with me that they would visit their priest or their minister to gain assurances that what they were doing was okay. When you have those kinds of conversations, you know that it's weighing heavily on people's minds.
And what about the families of the victims? What do you have a sense that, you know, we were saying a moment ago that there isn't closure because the appeals process goes on for so long and it constantly keeps it fresh in their mind, or at least from time to time it comes back up. But once those executions were completed, did you talk with the victims' families, and what sense did you get from them?
When the execution's completed, I honestly did not have the opportunity to talk to the victims' families. They seem anxious to leave the facility, quite frankly, and I can only say that from the looks on their face, I didn't get a sense that at that moment anyway, they felt any better or that they felt like they had closure. But again, I certainly can't speak for them.
You mentioned that some of the staff talked about discussing this with a clergy member, a priest or somebody. Mm-hmm. How did you deal with that personally?
I really told myself that I was being the professional person that I wanted to be, and that if executions were going to occur in this state, that it was my duty to carry out the law in a very professional way, be as kind as I could to everyone involved, and to really represent leadership. And I think I really lived with that ideal for a very long time. It wasn't until I really left San Quentin that I began to think about the toll that it took on me. And I knew that the last execution that I couldn't do, I could not carry out another execution. I really at that execution got sick to my stomach. It was so difficult for me to enter the execution chamber area and fulfill the responsibility.
And what was it about that particular execution?
I just think that it was the fourth one. I just think that it built up and just began to take a toll on me. There wasn't anything particular about that execution that I can recall. I just remember the night of the execution, everybody arriving there, the political figures that would show up, the witnesses, and just thinking about how surreal this all was and how bizarre it was, and that we as a civilized country would be doing such a thing as, planning and executing the death of an individual.
Talking to Jeannie Woodford, she was the warden at San Quentin for several years, oversaw four executions before becoming the director of California's Department of Corrections, and now she has a new job as head of Death Penalty Focus, which advocates against the death penalty. If you'd like to join our conversation this morning, the number to call is 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also post a comment or question on our website. It's KQED.org/forum, or you can go to the KQED Forum Facebook page. Jeannie Woodford, in terms of your own religion, tell us a little bit about that and your sense of spirituality and how that came in to your ultimate decision to leave San Quentin and, now to become director of Death Penalty Focus. Did that play a role?
Well, I was raised a Catholic, and so I certainly, it is certainly one of the reasons that I don't believe in the death penalty. Certainly, my religion and my beliefs about the death penalty played a role in me leaving San Quentin. Not only that, but being asked by Governor Schwarzenegger to be the Director of Corrections was an opportunity for me to leave San Quentin as the warden and not carry out executions and work on what I believed in, which is rehabilitation.
And I think didn't rehabilitation get added to the name, the California Department of Corrections and rehabilitation while you were there?
Yes, that's true.
Was that your doing?
I was part of that team. Our goal was to bring rehabilitation to the Department of Corrections. I mean, when you think about The fact that 90% of inmates who enter our Department of Corrections in California, return home, it's really important that they return home with the tools they need to do well out in our society. So that was our goal, yes.
Yeah. And you are not the only former warden at San Quentin who has come out against the death penalty, correct?
I don't know who has come out publicly, but I know that there are other wardens who are against it, yes.
And in their case, do you think that they, like you, never supported it, or did they see something? Was it being so close to it for so long that changed their minds?
I'm not certain whether they ever supported it. You know, I think anybody who's really been involved in this process ends up, if they didn't begin there, not believing that the death penalty provides for public safety or has any benefit for our society. It's expensive. It takes a toll on people. And we have an alternative to that provides for public safety, and that's life without possibility of parole. And when you look at other states, there's other wardens in other states who've come out against the death penalty. And I think that will continue to be the trend.
Yeah. And is that the focus of death penalty focus? Basically, you're trying – tell me what your group exactly wants and what are you advocating for?
Well, death penalty focus believes in educating the public about the death penalty, and our goal is the abolition of the death penalty. In addition to that, death penalty focus works on all justice issues. Mm-hmm. We believe in having an equitable justice system. So that's why I'm so excited to be a part of this organization.
Have you gotten – what kind of reaction have you had from former colleagues of yours? I mean, I know that you had been opposed to the death penalty publicly before taking this job, but were there other people, you know, either directly or indirectly who have said, you know, have been critical of you, you know, calling you – you know, saying you're soft on crime or you never should have been in this profession to begin with or anything like that?
I have not had that. Of course, the announcement about my role with Death Penalty Focus just came out last week, and so far everything I've received has been positive. And I wouldn't expect that people would be critical of my role. I think I've been very much very, very candid about what my beliefs are about criminal justice. And I've been working on criminal justice reform for a very long time.
What do you think is the state of corrections in California? We have overcrowded prisons. Death row is of course, very overcrowded. Most prisons in California are overcrowded. Is there a move? Do you think that the time is right because in part of budgetary issues to revisit some of these things?
Well, I think budgetary issues is driving reform. But I believe that many people in this state realized it was time to do something differently. I mean, the cost of corrections continued to go up. When I became the director of corrections, I believe the cost was around $32,000 or $33,000 per year per inmate. And now we're up at over $50,000 per year per inmate. And we were locking up too many people in this state, and many for non-serious, non-violent crimes. And so I think that people understood it was time for change, but I think the economic situation in California is moving that forward a little quicker. You have the governor coming out with a realignment plan for the state, which I think is a great idea.
And that would give counties more control and responsibility for parolees, and more people would go to county jails than to state prison. What else is important about that?
What's important about that is in 2009, for example, we had 47,000 inmates who spent less than 90 days in state prison. And, you know, I refer to that as the most expensive bus ride in California to nowhere. So you have individuals who end up on buses from county jails to the reception centers throughout the state, where we spend a great deal of money providing them with a physical and mental health exam, x-rays, lab work, all of that, only to pull them back out into the streets with nothing in their hand and no plan for success or plan for parole. And it's that group that we refer to as the catch and release, inmates who come in and out of the system with nothing being done to assist them to be successful in society.
The governor recently rejected plans to build a new death row at San Quentin Prison. People interpreted that in many different ways. He said we couldn't afford it. It was a budgetary issue. Some people, you know, it gives hope that perhaps this is the beginning of the end of the death penalty in California. What do you think? How do you read that?
I'm not reading anything into it. I know that we have a problem that needs to be solved. With over 700 inmates on death row, and we add, I believe, about 24, 25 inmates a year, or have been so far. So there's going to have to be some solution to that issue. When I was a warden at San Quentin, I advocated for a new death row, and I opened up death row to the media. And I said at that point in time, this is really a public policy issue, and the public needs to look at what exists and make a decision. It's not about whether you're for the death penalty or against the death penalty, but if you're going to have a death penalty, we're going to have to provide housing for inmates on death row that's appropriate.
So you think it was a mistake for him to go the other way on that, to decide not to build it?
I wouldn't say that. I don't know what the governor has in mind. We hope that the governor is thinking about commuting the sentences of inmates on death row. There's been a public poll that shows that the public would be in favor of that, 63%, because if the governor did that, we could save the state of California millions of dollars, $1 billion over 5 years.
All right. Let's go to the phones now. Your chance to talk with Jeannie Woodford, former warden at San Quentin Prison and the new executive director of Death Penalty Focus. The number here at Forum, 866-733-6786. Let's go first to Richmond, Virginia, and Brian is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. First of all, I'd like to say that I am against the death penalty. I think it's wrong for the state to murder citizens. But I have a more general comment, and that is I read a study recently that showed that in America we imprison, and this is not specific to California, but in America we imprison 465 per 100,000. There was no one even close to a second. And it makes me think that, because I just don't believe Americans are more criminal than other countries. I think that we're just criminalized too much. Everything, you know, our behaviors are well too regulated. Personal choice is regulated. And so I just was interested in hearing your comments about perhaps that point of view.
Jeannie?
Well, there was a study that came out, and it was headlines in the newspaper that said 1 in 100, referring to that 1 in 100 Americans is either in prison or jail in America, which is far higher than any other country. And we have longer sentences for most crimes, and we lock up many people for non-serious, non-violent offenses. Other countries treat that issue differently. So I think that we are beginning to look at that. And, you know, I'll use New York as an example, that it has managed to bring down their prison population while reducing crime all at the same time.
What did they do?
Well, they used, I think, many strategies, including more police on the street. Police on the street prevents crime. They also brought in more drug treatment and mental health treatment programs. So it was a holistic approach to this issue.
And they don't have the death penalty, by the way.
And that's correct. And so when people talk about the death penalty being a deterrent, in fact, the states that use the death penalty the most have higher crime rates than states that don't. And good point that New York does not have the death penalty and has a much lower crime rate than California does.
All right. Thanks, Brian, for the call. And people who support things like three strikes, California's very tough sentencing law, and the death penalty, they point to the dramatic drop in the crime rate in California over the past 15 years or so. What would you say to those folks who say, and this is why, we have the death penalty, we have three strikes?
What I would say is that crime is dropping all over the country, and states, again, that don't have the death penalty and don't have three strikes, like New York, have greater drops in violent crime than California has experienced. You can't tie the drop in crime in California to our sentencing structure, because we know people in criminal justice and experts in the field know that we have many problems with our sentencing scheme here in California.
All right. Jeannie Woodford will be with us for the rest of this hour. If you'd like to join our conversation and ask her a question or make a comment, it's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer, here this week for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this morning for Michael Krasny. And my guest this hour is Jeannie Woodford. She was San Quentin warden for several years before becoming the head of California's Department of Corrections. She's now the new executive director of Death Penalty Focus, which is a nonprofit anti-death penalty group. If you'd like to speak with her this morning or make a comment on what you've heard, 866-733-6786 is the number to call. Let's go now to Mike in San Francisco. Good morning.
Yes, hi. I just had a question for the former warden. I was curious if during the executions that you oversaw, do you have any interaction with the condemned directly or with their families? I was curious if there's any generalization you could make about the condemned person's demeanor just prior to their own execution. And that was it.
Okay, thank you.
From the time that we received the death warrant, which is 30 to 60 days prior to the execution, the warden spends quite a bit of time talking with the inmate who we're planning the execution of. And then the night of the execution, I would visit with the individual three or four times before midnight just to check on them, see how they're doing. And quite frankly, through that the course of the evening, they become resolved that they will be executed and really are very compliant with the process.
Is that standard operating procedure for the warden to do that, or is that something you did because that's what you wanted to do?
It is standard operating procedure. Talking to wardens in other states is exactly what they do. It just seems like the right thing to do for some reason.
If you can describe, like, what do you feel as you're talking with them? Do you feel compassion? Do you feel sorry for them? Do you feel, like, what is it exactly?
You feel all the whole range of emotions. You feel sad for everyone involved in this process, the inmate, the inmate's family, the victim's family. It's just a very difficult night because there are so many emotions and you understand people's emotions and you take that all in and you really... It really touches your heart in a way that I can't even describe.
We were talking earlier about rehabilitation and something that you very much support. And do you feel that people on death row, many of them or most of them, are capable of rehabilitation? I mean, or is that not the point of being against the death penalty?
It really isn't the point for being against the death penalty. And I do know inmates who were formerly on death row who did manage to rehabilitate themselves and who have paroled and done very well. So it is possible for any human being to be rehabilitated.
How do you go from death row to parole?
When the death penalty was declared unconstitutional, that whole group ended up being lifers because we didn't have the option of life without possibility of parole. And so many of those individuals have paroled and are law-abiding citizens. I know a couple who actually live in states with very reputable jobs. So I know that it's possible. But I think the point is that we do need to worry about public safety. We do need to hold people accountable. And that's why life without possibility of parole is an alternative. And when people have life without possibility of parole, there isn't an opportunity for them to parole. And people can rehabilitate themselves and work within our prison system to do some good. And you see inmates who do that as well.
Is that happening now in California? I mean, given the budget, I mean, is that R in CDCR? Is it real or is it imagined?
Well, I think it's very difficult and it's imagined in most of the prisons because of our budget crisis. But you end up with a prison like San Quentin that has the benefit of having so many volunteers go in and out of there every day. And my last year there, 3,000 volunteers a year coming in and out of that prison. It runs a university project with all volunteer professors. So there are bright spots.
That's a real exception, though, isn't it?
It is an exception, but it really should be the rule. And you see the inmates that I know that have paroled from San Quentin who were life crime inmates are doing very well because of the programs that were available to them.
All right. Let's go back to the phones now. Bob in San Ramon, welcome to the program.
Hi. Yeah, my question is, especially if people get convicted at 18 or 20 and then get a life sentence without the possibility of parole, that could be 60 years. Does that violate the constitutional clause against cruel and unusual punishment? That we better just put them out of their misery than serve 60 years in a box?
Well, I don't know that it violates cruel and unusual punishment, but people can be productive within our prison system. I think that people don't realize that we inmates in California make all the eyeglasses that are used for individuals on Medi-Cal, for example. They make school furniture. They provide many products that are used by the state of California, including license plates and license tags, things like that. So I think people can make a life for themselves within the prison system, pay restitution to victims' family members through their labor, and provide benefit to the state in a way of giving back for what they have done.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go now to Lee. I'm sorry, to Glenn in Tahoe City. Welcome.
Yes, this kind of goes right along with what you just made a comment about. I'm curious why we don't use this manpower that is imprisoned and put on them the taking care of the state parks or the situations that we have. You know, we don't have money to pay for these things. So why don't we use this manpower that we have to do that?
Well, in many ways we do. For example, our fire camps, our inmate labor. So most of our fires are fought by inmates who are level one, meaning they're minimum security. And they do a lot of flood protection, prevention rather. And they do work in some of our state parks. Could that be expanded? That would be up to our policymakers in this state.
Are there still, is there resistance from unions? Who feel in some cases that they're taking away, you know, union jobs.
That's true. There is some resistance from unions. And, you know, I think that is important. We shouldn't replace our union labor through inmate labor. That's certainly would be contrary to our culture and what we believe in. But there certainly is a role for inmates to learn skills while they work so that they can be productive members when they parole from our system.
How tough is it for a parolee to get a job in California? Because if they don't get a job, they're going to probably end up either at the very least on public assistance, but perhaps right back in prison.
Inmates who leave our state prison system with job skills seem to do really well. And so that's really the key. They need to have the skills that
demands. Is it tough to find employers who are willing to take a chance on a you know, an ex-felon?
When you have programs in place where the employer knows who they're getting, it makes it easier. And there are a few of those programs within the Department of Corrections. PIA, Prison Industries Authority, is one of those where they really define who the person is so that when you're hiring that individual, you know who he is, him or her, and you know what they've done while they've been in prison.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Arturo is on the line from San Jose. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Just a comment to your speaker. First of all, I really enjoy you being so enlightened about your position. My question to you is this. I mean, being a woman and a warden, how does that impact your positioning? And whether other wardens or ex-wardens, whether men or women, share your position across the country?
Jeannie Woodford?
Take my question up here.
All right. Thanks so much. We talked about that a little bit, just the role of women behind bars and limitations perhaps. But did you feel that you had to, you know, sort of earn your stripes in a way that perhaps a male warden wouldn't have?
I think that's true. As a woman, I believe that people attempt to accuse you of being too soft-hearted or too soft on crime. And really what I talk about is being holding people accountable. And so you have to overcome that. And it takes a while for people to trust you because this really is a male profession. And people who know me know that I'm not soft on crime at all. I do believe in accountability. And I actually believe that some of our sentencing laws need to be changed so that people are held accountable for what they do while they're incarcerated to improve themselves. So that's a challenge for a woman in this business.
If memory serves, you didn't stay on as director of the California Department of Corrections very long after the governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, asked you to do that. How long was it and why did you leave?
I was the director actually for a little over a year, and then I was asked to be the undersecretary for the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. That's when we added the R. And I stayed in that job for just a year. And I left that job because I came to realize that there was no way to be successful without sentencing reform. You can't have people coming into the prison system for 30 days or 60 days or 90 days by the hundreds. And in California's case, 47,000 spending less than 90 days, and expect to do anything that's going to improve public safety with that individual. In addition, I think that we have many violent felons that come into our prison system who are allowed to parole having done nothing to fix who they are. And we're not providing the right programs for them as well. And so I saw a real need to get serious about sentencing reform and did not think that that administration was ready to do that.
What kind of sentencing reform? What would you support?
Well, I would support keeping people who are low-end offenders serving 2 years or less at the local level. Prisons should be for the higher-end offender. And I really believe that we need a return to indeterminate sentencing for more violent crimes, as other states have.
Indeterminate, meaning there's no flexibility.
That individuals come in serving a minimum, which is the punishment piece, and then would appear before the Board of Parole hearings to be given a release date when they prove themselves worthy of returning back to our society.
So they have an incentive to learn. And
they have an incentive to not be gang members. They have an incentive to participate in education or vocational programs. And then we also have a responsibility to provide those programs so that individuals can prove that they're ready to return back to our society. I mean, there are many times that we parole people that you just knew were going to hurt someone. And I think it makes it very difficult for everyone involved in this system when you have sentencing laws that don't hold people accountable for change.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Nancy in Berkeley, you're on with Jeannie Woodford. Good morning. Nancy, are you there?
Oh, hello. I can barely hear you. That's my problem. Hello. I'm Nancy Jakes Alexander, and Ms. Woodford, it's an honor to speak with you. I have just completed 25 years of volunteering up at Vacaville Penitentiary, and I'm the co-founder of the hospice up there. And the hospice volunteers are fellow inmates, and so I wanted to stress what you said about rehabilitation. Most of the devoted volunteers in the hospice are men who are life without possibility of parole, LWOPs, and I have seen men change. I know it is possible. But what I really would like to ask you is about the parole process. In the process of the hearings, does the family or the survivors of the victim, how much of an input do they have in the decision making of the parole board? Because I have also worked with victims of survivors of very brutal crimes.
Well, first, let me thank you for your service. Volunteering for 25 years is phenomenal, and we need more people like you coming into the Department of Corrections. But I think, rightly so, the parole board does listen to the surviving family members. They have a right to appear at parole hearings. I don't know that what they have to say weighs on the parole board's decision, but they don't get to make the decision as to whether someone's released or not. But they should be heard. And I think it's an opportunity for the inmate to talk to the family members and, you know, share what that individual has done to repair or restore what he has done to that family.
Let me just follow up. And Nancy said she works in the hospice, and California now has a medical parole law that allows inmates who are injured or sick in a way that deems them basically no longer a threat to society. There was an article just yesterday in the Chronicle about a man who is a quadriplegic. He was stabbed while he was in prison. I believe he struck with a car some women and kidnapped one of them, tried to kill one of them, and was arrested. He's now in prison, and he's got a parole hearing coming up. And there are people who feel that he hasn't at all shown remorse, hasn't really been rehabilitated, and yet is up for the possibility of medical parole. His medical condition costs taxpayers a huge amount of money. Mm-hmm. What do you think about a case like that? Maybe you don't know all the details, but is he a good candidate for a medical parole?
Well, I certainly couldn't speak to his case because I don't know what he's done or hasn't done. But I think that the medical parole allows for the opportunity for him to be released. And that also has to be approved by the Board of Prison Terms. So I imagine that they would take that all into consideration and reach the right decision.
It seems to be a lot of these reform ideas are being driven by money. Is that the right driver, do you think?
Well, I think that they're being moved forward because of our economic situation in California. But many of these reform issues have been discussed for several years as we've come to realize that our prison system is very overcrowded and that we can't build our way out of this problem. The state simply can't afford it. So I think that the many programs or many ideas that have been studied over the last 5 to 10 years are now being brought forward because of our economic situation.
All right. Let's go now to Sunnyvale. Judith is on the line. Good morning.
Morning. I do not support the death penalty either, but I do feel that survivors, family, friends of victims of horrific crimes would not want the perpetrators of these crimes to be able to be in general population, being able to have the privileges of general population prisoners.
What are your thoughts about that? Because I suspect she's right. In fact, in that article I alluded to a moment ago with this, the quadriplegic, some of the victim's family members were saying, you know, he shouldn't be allowed to sit around all day and watch TV at home. He shouldn't have any of the comforts that others of us have. What are your thoughts about the – even if we do go to a system of life without the possibility of parole, under what kinds of conditions should those inmates be living, do you think?
Well, no inmate is in general population unless they earn the privilege to be there, meaning that they have to behave themselves and follow the rules, and they also have to participate in work or programs to improve who they are, meaning they go to school or they participate in a vocational program. But eventually, inmates who serve long periods of time will work, and they must pay restitution when they have employment. So I think that goes a long way to benefit the victims. And I don't think we want inmates just sitting in their cell watching TV or laying around a yard doing nothing. I think we do want them being productive and being held accountable.
Does that respond to your question, Judith?
I guess it does. Thank you.
Okay. I know that it's a very difficult issue for victims, family members. And I certainly understand that, and I don't want to minimize that. But you know, is the answer really to have someone sitting on death row, maybe for the rest of their life, in a cell, watching TV and going out to an exercise yard, doing nothing to give back to our society? I just don't think it is.
It does speak to the pain that these crimes cause for families, the difficulty of finding a solution that is, you know, both just and fair and satisfying to the families.
I totally agree, and I think we need to do more work with victims, and I think that the money that we save from ending capital punishment should be directed towards victims in our society, because there certainly are lots of people who are victims in our society.
866-733-6786, the number to call here on Forum if you want to talk with Jeanne Woodford. And let's go now to Milpitas, and Lee is on the line. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Good morning, Scott and Jeanne. Thanks very much for this program. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go right ahead.
My question is about the justification for the death penalty that I was told when I was young, which has to do with the impulse toward revenge by individuals who may have had a murder committed against their family. And you know, I was told that the state takes on the role of deciding who was guilty and what to do about that, including execution. And I'm just wondering, as you continue to advance the arguments that you are advancing and bringing our society toward a more rational way of dealing with these issues, whether we might also recognize the impulse toward forgiveness, maybe a difficult thing to discuss in this context with victim families, but seems to me to need to be part of this, you know, addressing this particular justification for the death penalty as well as the alternative.
Jeanne?
Well, I've heard victims, family members say that forgiveness is a gift they give themselves. It's not for the individual. Living with the thought of revenge or retribution for 25 years, and even in other states where they execute people more quickly, it's still 10 or 11 years, can't be healthy for people. But again, I really hesitate to speak on behalf of victims. I would hope that we as a society would spend a great deal more time figuring out a better response to these horrific crimes.
To what extent do you hear from families of victims who are also against the death penalty?
We actually have a growing number of individuals who belong to Death Penalty Focus and who work on the behalf of Death Penalty Focus to end the death penalty and seek alternatives to the death penalty because they realize that having a punishment that's just about revenge or retribution doesn't really give them the assistance that they need. And many of our victims who participate in Death Penalty Focus have had family members killed, and the perpetrator of that crime has not been found. And they really would like to see the resources that are spent on the death penalty in this state spent finding the person who is responsible for killing their loved one. And, really the greatest prevention to crime is solving crime. And it's important that we spend our very limited and precious resources doing that.
You're listening to Forum, and we're talking this hour to former San Quentin warden Jeannie Woodford. She's the new executive director of Death Penalty Focus. This, as you may have noticed, is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. And for more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer. And we continue now with Jeannie Woodford. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786. Let's go to Violetta. Welcome.
Hi. I was wondering if you could speak to some of the cultural or social differences in the U.S. Compared to other developed nations in answering the question of why we're one of the few westernized countries to not have abolished the death penalty.
Well, I think that's a very good point. We are not in very good company on this issue. The other nations that continue to have the death penalty are Iraq, Iran, countries that we have a great deal of difficulty dealing with how they treat people. And I think that that is why, as we think about these issues more thoughtfully, that we're ready in the United States to get rid of capital punishment. Illinois recently did so, and I think that there'll be a growing trend.
Why do you think the United States is still, one of the very few countries that has the death penalty?
Well, I do think that we still believe that there are some crimes so horrific.
But why? What is it? I mean, I'm sure people all over the world feel that way.
I wish I knew really the answer to that. It just seems to be a part of our culture here that many people believe in an eye for an eye. And that isn't my attitude, so it is hard for me to understand that.
All right. Violetta, thanks very much for the call. Let's go now to Stefan. Welcome to the program.
Yes, hi. Good morning. Thank you for the program, and thank you for taking my question. Ms. Woodford, you characterized the preparation for an execution earlier as a preparation for murder. So my question is, do you think that if in some future point we abolish the death penalty, that we should go back and prosecute people that participated in that murder for a crime? Or how do you feel about dealing with that in the future?
I think, and I know that you're referring to me, I will tell you that I believe that we were carrying out the law of the state, and so my answer would be no. But I certainly understand why other people would have a different opinion.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. What you obviously struggled very, very much with these executions. What did you do afterwards, after the night of an execution or the next morning?
The next morning, I would return home and actually arrive at my home probably at about 2 a.m. and spend an hour just really quiet time by myself. And then I would get up at 6 a.m. and be back in the prison the next morning, returning it back to normal. And I just think it was really a way to avoid thinking about it too deeply. Just jump right back into the job, being sure that staff was okay, unlocking the prison, getting it back to normal as quickly as possible.
Yeah, and did you talk with a priest, or I mean, do you still consider? You said you were raised Roman Catholic. Do you still consider? Are you still practicing Catholic?
I do go to church from time to time, not as much as I should, but yes, I still am a part of the Catholic Church.
Did you seek any kind of counseling
before
or after?
I did not. I considered myself to be a very spiritual person, and so I spend a lot of time in my own head thinking these things through.
All right, let's go now to Fairlawn, New Jersey, and Henry is on the line. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. First, Ms. Whitford, I want to just acknowledge your tremendous courage over the years in doing what you have done. My question is this. So while you were warden and oversaw those four specific executions, did it ever occur to you on any of those occasions to, given what your perspective is on things, to simply say, no, we're not going to go forward with this?
No, it really did not occur to me, because I knew that if it wasn't me, it would be someone else. And my whole goal, honestly, was to work with everyone involved and to be as professional as possible and as kind as possible.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Let's see if we can maybe get one more call in. Brad in San Francisco. We're short on time, but please go ahead.
Thank you. Real quick, I wanted to ask, California has a really strong prison guards union, and what do you think their thoughts are on sentencing reform?
Thanks for your brevity.
I think CCPOA, which is the union you're referring to, believes it's time for sentencing reform. They've come a long way in their thinking and understand that we can't continue to add to our prison population. The state simply can't afford it.
What about the death penalty?
I don't know where they stand on the death penalty. I know that they have members who are for and against it, and I hope they'll listen to all their members when arriving at a decision on this issue.
We're short on time, but you're in your new job now. What's your top priority, short term?
My short-term priority is to meet with as many people as possible and to grow the number of people who believe it's time to end capital punishment in this state and save us a lot of money and get to an appropriate punishment life without possibility of parole.
All right. Jeannie Woodford, she's the new executive director of Death Penalty Focus. By the way, we have a link to their organization on our website, KQED.org/forum. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell, with help this week from Tina Lauerberg and Christina Russo. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer today is Danny Bringer. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer, here this week for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.